Good morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Education to order. President or Representative Keller, Munoz, Wilson, Gardner, Book, and Chair Seaton. Don't forget your cell phones. And today we will discuss House Bill 137, the Compact for Education of Military Children. And then we will also discuss HB 184 debt authorization for the university. Is there anything to come before the committee before we get started? Okay, appreciate that. We have the bill before us as a sponsor. No, we had the sponsor introduce the bill. We had discussion. We had public testimony. Before I go to you, is there further public testimony on the on HB 137? Anyone in the audience? Anyone online? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public testimony. And we have the administration here. And welcome, Commissioner. Would you introduce yourself on the record and go ahead with your analysis of the bill for us?
Thank you, Chair Seaton. My name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development, and I'm here today to provide support for House Bill 137. This morning, Eddie Jeans is going to give you an overview of the bill, and then we'll answer any questions that you may have regarding the bill. I would like to share with you that I've been worked in a district that had a substantial military population for 30 years, and I grew up in the same community, and I can tell you that my support for this bill comes from the experiences generated both as a teacher, principal, and superintendent of a district with a large number of military kids. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Carol Como was able to testify on Friday.
She was.
Okay, great. She had left me a message. She had another meeting to go to, so I wanted you to know that Anchorage School District does support this bill, as well as I saw you had a letter from the Kodiak Island School District in support of the bill. Mr. Chairman, before I go through the bill itself, I wanted to touch briefly on the fiscal note. The fiscal note is for $22,300. There's an annual membership fee to be a member of the Interstate Compact. That fee is $1 per child, military child, in the state of Alaska. We have approximately 16,200 students that are military dependents in the state of Alaska. The other $6,100 would be for travel expenses, because we have to have a mini cabinet here in Alaska to oversee the implementation of the compact. And our recommendations on that council would be the Commissioner of Education, the superintendents of Anchorage and Fairbanks school districts. We would recommend a state legislator be appointed to the council, as well as the military advisor that's currently appointed to the State Board of Education, and that would make up our in-state council to oversee the administration of the compact. Mr. Chairman, first, as I'm sure you're well aware from Friday's meeting, that the Interstate Compact is a compact between state agencies or state governments. And basically, Section 1 outlines the enactment of the compact at the state level. Article 2, starting on page 2, outlines the definitions that will be utilized throughout the compact law itself. And then moving on to page 5, Article 4 is the educational records and enrollments. This sets out, I'm sorry, I should start with Article 3, the applicability. Basically, this outlines who is covered under the compact, which is basically all your military families, Coast Guard, the active services, and National Guard when they're in active duty. Article 5 is the educational records and enrollment. This outlines the the process or the timelines for records when they are received from a student entering into your educational system and within your state. Mr. Chairman, before I get into all this, I mean, when I went through this, basically we're doing 95% of what's in this compact already. Sure. And there's a couple areas that that are a little bit different than our current state laws. And the first one that comes to mind is the immunization. Currently, we require all students to provide immunization records before they start public school. This allows families up to 30 days to produce those immunization records, the compact does. We also currently have an agreement with Health and Social Service that allows homeless children that 30-day window as well. So it's not like it would be specifically for the military families. It also applies to, not this particular, but we have an MOU that applies to homeless children in the state. So another one has to do with student activities. When students come into the state, they have a waiting period before they can participate in athletics association activities, and it's like a 90-day window. There's a waiver provision in there that allows the districts to apply for the waiver. And so I had contacted the director of that organization, Gary Matthews, and he indicated to me that through that waiver provision, military children would be allowed to participate immediately. So,
and question A, did they have objections to that?
The association did not.
Okay.
Thank you. In fact, I'd be happy to provide you with a copy of that email. He said they would be able to make it work.
Yeah. That's fine. Okay. Representative Gardner has a question.
Thank you. I actually have three questions on Article 2. On the Section C, the provisions of this contract shall not apply to the children of, and then it lists people, just clear. There's no prohibition about applying it to people who are not otherwise defined in here. It's simply that it's not going to be a requirement for those people. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. And on the immunization, with the 30-day window for military and home that we have for homeless kids, is it fair to assume that if these are children whose parents are active duty, that they're immunized through the military programs? I mean, that they would have a high rate of compliance with immunizations anyway?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, first of all, I can't tell you what the immunization requirements are from state to state, but I believe that with the high mobility of the military families, they're going to have access to those immunization records probably more readily available than some of us that don't move around too much.
Thank you.
So I really don't see the immunization as a real issue.
Okay, and then
Representative Gardner.
Thirdly, on student activities and athletics, as I understand it, one of the concerns and the reason there is a prohibition against participation is to discourage students from moving around simply because of athletics, to pick a school with a coach and transferring over there. So many of these provisions I just soon see applied to all kids because they don't choose by their parents. But for the athletic one, that is a little bit different in my mind. Is that part of the concern? Is that the reason that we don't allow kids generally to transfer to a new school and then participate in athletics immediately?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that's exactly.
And Commissioner, would you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development. And generally speaking, transfer rules are to prevent recruiting of students for high school athletic teams. I can tell you, from sitting on the state athletic board for 4 years, you can't make enough rules to stop that. People find a way, but that's generally what these rules are for.
Thank you.
Okay, and Eddie, you're going to supply us, for the record, with that copy of that email from the athletic.
I'd be happy to.
So that
to.
It can go with the packet.
Yes.
So that question is answered for the next committee.
Thank be happy you. To.
Are there other questions at this point? Okay, go ahead, Eddie. I think that we're approaching this in the right way, looking at any identifiable problems. Ray, you don't need to go through section by this section before.
Okay.
If you would go through and identify any of those places where there's differences with our current practices or that would be possibly at odds with.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, there's just a couple other places that rise to that level, I believe. And the first one is advanced placement, students that are taking advanced placement courses. The compact requires that when the family shows up in the state and they indicate that their child's been in an advanced placement course, you don't have to wait for the transcripts to show up to validate that. And in fact, that you would actually place them if space is available in an advanced placement course immediately to not disrupt their education. And then the other one has to do with the high school qualifying exam. And it requires that if a student has passed a high school qualifying exam in another state, that they are exempt from your state test. Or if they come in as a senior, that they're exempt from your test. And we already have that in a regulation. So it was a concern that was raised, but our regulation already addresses it, almost like mirrors the compact. So those are the only other areas that that I wanted to make you aware of.
And Eddie, I think that the only area of concern that I've heard was, you know, we've heard about the cheerleader that came in that was a professional, you know, had been on state cheerleading competition, being really good, but wasn't able to participate. You know, we've got the sports example, and we've got the advanced placement. And I heard on advanced placement you said if there was space available in the class.
Correct.
There was some concern from the testimony that if, you know, you went through all the competition or elections through the school and then somebody came in, does that mean, and wants to participate in that, does that mean the school has to stop and go back and have their new election of cheerleaders, or that the team has to rearrange itself, or it just gives the school the ability to incorporate?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding it does not require you to go back and redo the whole tryouts and all that, that if there's space available or you would accept that child, any child coming into your district to participate in those sports that they or activities, that they would be allowed to do so. So it, again, it's on a space available basis. If a student was to show up halfway through the basketball season and there's no space, that's the way it is. But if they were to show up at the beginning of the school year, say when tryouts have been going on for 3 weeks already, but the team hasn't been selected, you have to give them an opportunity to participate.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to get that on the record as to what parameters that set as far as participation coming in and guarantees and what space had to be made available. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, how are they going to do that with a cheerleader? I mean, you know, these girls get all excited and they're the head honcho in their school where they're at and they're coming to this school, and the cheerleading team has just already had their tryouts and there's no space, then they just aren't going to get to do it, right?
That would be my understanding.
Because follow-up, Representative?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
And the reason I asked that is because that was one of the letters that was in back in here in our packet where a girl came and so she felt left out the whole year because she was really looked up to in the other school because she was a cheerleader and now she's not. But I don't know how we can fix that that particular problem if the cheerleading team is full, you know.
Well, and through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's also maintaining grades and that kind of thing. So if a position came open on the team, they would have the ability to apply for that open slot. But if the team is filled, and it has been filled, it doesn't automatically grant a military child access to that.
Commissioner Ledoux.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. What we find is that most schools have protocols within the school to determine how they view students who transfer in on teams. If you have a 7.5-footer transfer in the middle of basketball season, I guarantee that they will find a way to. And it's the same with most activities, band, choir, drama. What If it doesn't do is guarantee them a spot above other students. So if an AP class is full and students who are in the school can't get into it, it doesn't allow somebody coming in to have access, you know, over those other kids.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Did you have either of you have any further comments? Are there further questions for the administration? Representative Munoz.
I have a question. Thank you. Are there examples in Alaska where kids have been hindered entering into new schools, military kids, because of current regulations? A lot of the background points to examples in other states, and I'm just wondering if we have a problem here in Alaska. And I support the bill. I'm just curious if.
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, and my name is Larry Ledoux. I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development. I'll give you one example that I remember as a high school principal. We had a student who, because of transfer, was necessary for them to leave their school district down south 5 days before graduation. So the student left 5 days before finals, and the sending district would not grant credit to this student, which meant the student would not graduate. And so I had this student in my school. One day, he showed up the first day of finals, his senior year. The school would not grant credit for one semester of work because he left 5 days early. And, you know, I moved it all the way through the superintendent level, and they just said, no, that's our policy. And so I have this student who's not going to graduate and go to college. And so I chose to offer credit for all of his classes, having seen that student one day. Okay, and that shouldn't have occurred. And I believe that, you know, I could give you other examples, but I believe that this is a law of common sense. Most schools in Alaska with military youth follow these protocols already, and that's why you see such unprecedented support from school districts, because they already do most of these things. I think they also recognize that they've seen abuses in their own district. And what I see the good of it is not so much for Alaska, but a statement of what we want other states to do when they look at their military youth. So I think it's very important.
Right. Follow up? Are there any further questions for the commissioner or for the director?
What's his name? Eddie?
No, I was trying to think of the title. I remember your name all the time. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, it just seems to me like if I had a child that, I mean, I'm going to back to that. If I had a child that only had 5 days left of school, I would have been in there saying, give him his tests early and let's get this on the road so that when we leave, he already has graduated. Evidently, I think there must have been a lack of communication on the other end, but.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. They knew exactly what they were doing, the schools, and they refused credit. I can tell you that the stress on families whose parents or one of the other parents is deployed and the movement from school to school is real on these kids. And while I would like to believe that the majority of decisions made by educators throughout the country always keep the best interests of children in sight, that's not always the case. Sometimes the bureaucracy is more important than the child. And in this case, this law says the child is more important than the bureaucracy. And so it's necessary.
And I imagine that example was before No Child Left Behind, because they wouldn't want their graduation rate to suffer. I'll bet there would have been a different outcome now. But are there further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We're open for committee discussion. Amendments? Is there any committee discussion on the bill? Any amendments? What's the will of the committee? Representative Wilson?
Are you ready for
a motion? Sure.
Okay, I move that we move House Bill number 137, version R, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing no objections, House Bill 137 will move from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you very much. And now we will.
There's a police rally.
go to House Bill 184, debt reimbursement by the university, or the debt authorization for the university. And we have the sponsor here, Representative Kelly. Would you come forward?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mike Kelly, representative from District 7.
And can I ask you to shove that mic a little further away?
Okay. And this is my staff member, Derek Miller, and he'll be presenting the bill. So I think I'll just, in the face of his tremendous knowledge about the subject, I'm going to stop right here.
That'd be fine. Would you identify yourself on the record and go ahead with the presentation of the bill?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Derek Miller, aide to Representative Kelly. And House Bill 184 before you adjusts the current bond debt cap for the University of Alaska to reflect today's construction prices. Current Alaska statute allows the university to issue debt as long as the annual debt service payment doesn't exceed $1 million without a legislative authorization. So this bill simply bumps up that threshold to $2.5 million. The current bond debt cap limit of $1 million was issued in 1990, so you can see it's been about 18, 19 years since that current issue, current statute was put into place. That annual debt service back then was the cost of financing approximately a $15 million capital project. So taking construction inflation into consideration in Alaska, a $15 million capital project built in 1990 would cost about $40 million today. The university has operated a viable debt program for over the last 18 years. It has issued 14 general revenue bonds plus other financing arrangements that has been critical in securing capital projects. And the main takeaways with this bill is I'd like to press upon you is that the university has been an excellent steward of debt. They have a high grade credit rating, meaning that they're a safe investment, low risk. Their current amount of outstanding debt is less than half of the Board of Regents policy limit. And finally, this bill allows you to, it eases the administrative burden of compliance with the statute for smaller bond issues. It'll reduce that for both the legislature and the university, while at the same time retain oversight by the legislature on capital projects for the University of Alaska. And with that, I can take any questions that you may have. And I believe we have Myron Dosh, who's the University of Alaska controller, online and available for questions. Who knows more about this than anybody? So.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Booth?
I was thinking about some, but I do have one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We do have a number of requests from the university, and under the worst or best case scenario, whichever you choose, should they get all of their requests for from the legislature, would this cap allow for their participation at the maximum level that they're seeking? Is that one of the reasons they're doing this, Derek?
Representative Book, through the chair, this bill is just to reflect the changing environment of building a construction project and to inflation adjust the cap. But specifically to your question, this would impact potentially if the legislature were to authorize receipt authority for a couple of current projects that the university is proposing. It would affect that, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a problem with this per se, but I do have a problem if it's going to make any difference toward raising tuition, because I think our tuition rates are about as high as we can get in Alaska, and I don't want to see any tuition hikes. And would you object to a amendment that would put that in there?
Representative Kelly,
yes,
go ahead.
Through the chair to Representative Wilson. A couple of points. One, As Derek mentioned, the university oversight is still there because not a penny of the bonding can be used without receipt authority, and the legislature approves the receipt authority for any particular use of funds. So I think there's an automatic guard place there. Of course, it's in place now, and will still be in place if this bill passes. This just merely makes the level of bonding to accomplish the same chores current, and it does another thing which interests me, and that is that more and more, as I've been watching the state amount of funds put into the university as compared with other funding, has flipped over. It's gone from 60% state funding and 40% all other, to exactly the mirror image of that, where our funding at the state level has now down 40% range roughly. So the university's been pretty aggressive in both overheads for contracting and attracting, as we know, the outside funding coming into the university. So I think that the answer to your question is, could a project that something like this would support eventually result in a tuition rise? Yes. For example, the one I'm most familiar with close to home up there is the students elected to take an increase in tuition to cover the rec center. And so the rec center was bonded, and it's worked out very well. It's paid for by the students. And so the answer to that question of yours is yes, it could impact tuition just like any other financial move anywhere. But I would be opposed to amending it to where we send the signal that the Board of Regents can't adjust tuition in any manner that would be affected by this debt cap, because this is strictly trying to take something that has become this size down to less than half of its former impact, to going back up and recognizing that there's been a change over time. Long answer to a short question: yes, it could impact tuition, but it's not the act. It's not this action that would trigger it. It's strictly that the regents might assign a tuition increase in any given year for whatever reason. There have been quite a few tuition increases, but it wouldn't be triggered. It would not be caused by this, because this strictly permits the university to bond for these smaller amounts, as it always has, but it's become a punier amount because of inflation. So I'll stop there.
I follow up, Representative Wolf.
Yes, thank you. Do you know how many tuition increases have been, how many there have been in the last 10 years?
Well, you're looking at two regents, and maybe Derek, do you know that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I was on the board.
Would you identify yourself, too?
Derek Miller, staff to Representative Kelly. I was on the board in 2002, 2003, and the first year I was on it as a student was the first year that they hiked up tuition by 10% for 4 years in a row. So from 03, 04, 05, and 06, it was 10%, and I believe it was the Higher Education Price Index plus a little bit more after that, but not quite 10%. So that kind of gives you an idea of what it's been like.
Yeah, so I'm very concerned about that, because that's what the universities nationwide have been doing. And I feel that it's got to stop. You know, the universities, I guess I want it on record that if they can't, I think there's too many people that can't afford it anymore. And that the university needs to think of how to work in another way than just increasing the tuition every time. And I just kind of, I won't do anything now, but I think that they need to be aware that there's got to be a stop somewhere to keep raising the tuition.
And Representative Kelly, I have a question on the structure of how that recreation facility went in Fairbanks. I believe that was Fairbanks. So that increased the tuition. Did that increase it all across the system, or was that a specific surcharge that was added to Fairbanks?
It was a specific surcharge, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, great. Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you.
I don't. Yeah, I had a question. That's fine. I can wait. Go ahead.
I don't have any problem with this. It seems eminently reasonable, but I'm sort of struck by the thinness of the file. Have you asked for letters of support from the university or from financial interest markets? Or, I mean, is there? I'd like to get some kind of backup.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, we do have Myron Dosh available online if he can speak to it from the university standpoint. Do not have a letter from the university specifically.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll get to him in a moment. Then we have Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Just wanted to point out that the opportunity to issue debt is now about $317 million, according to your sponsor statement, and that changing the cap doesn't affect that amount of potential bonding ability. And therefore, would it affect, because of the fact that it doesn't affect the total ability to bond, would it affect tuition rates then? Or am I not understanding? I don't think it would if it's not affecting the total bonded indebtedness possibility.
Let me identify yourself. Two male voices. We just need your name. We don't need positions or anything, but for the secretary, thanks.
Derek, staff to Representative Kelly, Derek Miller, staff to Representative Kelly, Representative Munoz through the chair. The total outstanding debt that the university is authorized to issue has to do with Board of Regents policy, which currently sets that limit at 5% of unrestricted revenues. So that's separate from this bond debt cap, this annual debt service. And as it relates to tuition, I'd have to refer to Representative Kelly on that. You're always going to, if the university needs to bond and it's above this threshold, they'll just come to you to bond it. So,
okay. But changing the cap doesn't affect that total, the opportunity to bond, that $317 million.
Correct. Representative Munoz.
Representative Book.
Through the chair, Representative Kelly, did you want to respond to that?
Derek, hit the point I was going to make.
Okay.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Legislative Aide Miller, what involvement do the students have in their ability to impact tuition? Do they have any involvement in that process at all anymore? I know at one time they used to.
Derek Miller, staff to Representative Kelly, Representative Book through the chair. There is a student regent on the Board of Regents. So as a voting member, which not all states have a student regent on the board, that's actually quite it's quite a thing to have a voting power on the Board of Regents. So there is a say at that level, and there is a governance structure for staff, faculty, and students there, so that there is a say. But ultimately, it comes down to the Board of Regents. As it relates to the SRC, the Student Recreation Center, was mentioned earlier. The students actually voted to build that facility back in the late 80s, early 90s. I wasn't there at that time, but when I was attending the university, it was a $75 fee for the semester for that facility. So that's kind of where their input is, and they can also vote in fees if they want to, if they want a facility built on their own.
Reverend Book, follow-up.
One follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you end up paying for that encumbrance with those 10% per year increases that you went to school?
Reverend Book, was I paying that 10% increase in tuition? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm asking you is some of the decisions that were made prior to you. Did you end up paying for that?
Representative Book through the chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, and I don't know which one of you wants to answer it, is I don't know what percentage of kids going to school pay for their own tuition or how many parents pay it. But You know, I think that kids, where their parents are paying, they really don't care if it's going to be hiked because they don't have to deal with it. So I don't know what the percentage is or anything like that, but does anybody know?
I don't know.
Derek Miller, staff to Representative Kelly, Representative Wilson. I do not know the numbers off the top of my head. I'm sure I can try to extrapolate those for reference. I can tell you from my own experience, it's a combination of my own money through work, student work, student assistant positions, and then my parents helped me out when I needed it, when I was short. But for the most part, it was my own money.
And Representative Wilson, before we request that they get us that, I'm not sure that that's going to be available of how individual students personally finance.
It might
their,
not be. I don't know.
So, you know, I don't need it
before this bill goes.
Okay. Because I wouldn't want to put the burden on you guys to do something that is confidential information of how a student pays. I mean, the check comes in, but how that's done, other than scholarship money, I'm sure we can get scholarship and loan, possibly some identification loan amounts, but how many parents write the check or how many students write the check, I think would be something that probably is not going to be available to us as a, you know, so.
Well, if it's available.
If it's available, that's fine. I just wanted to get that clarification. Thank you. Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that point, I can give you personal experience. I have two kids, and they're paying 100% of theirs. There's no way I could afford it going out of state. So a lot of my friends, it's the same thing. If they wanted to go to school, they either got a scholarship, they got a grant, or they got a loan. And so I have two kids. Currently, they have $75,000 of indebtedness. So they're starting out there like with a mortgage payment for a home. That's just the way it is. So.
Okay, thank you. I don't think I had a question, or was there? No. On the bill itself, on lines 9 through 12, which is existing law, says the university may not enter into an obligation requiring finance notice under this section, other than refinancing obligation, unless the project has been approved by the legislature by law. Does that mean that this $40 million cap, then, they don't need to come to the legislature unless it's above the $2.5 million financing debt cap? I mean, I've heard it said that we have to approve, but it seems like this law is saying that unless it's above the previous $1 million cap or they proposed $2.5 million, they don't have to come to the legislature. And that's on page 1 of the bill, lines 9 through 11. And while we're all studying that, let's just take a brief of these. We'll come back on the record, and we took a moment just so everybody could read the language. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mike Kelly. And as you pointed out, this is in existing law, and this would not intend to affect that. But my understanding of this is that the bonding is separate from the approval, so that the receipt authority is generated by the legislative action. All this does is says that for example, if that receipt authority is from bonds, this merely says that in the act of bonding, the approval is not required for either the old $1 million under the current law or going up to the higher amount under $2.5 million, I believe it is, under this proposed legislation. So it doesn't affect it, and our understanding of how it works and what this language means is that it is not taking away the power of the legislature over projects. It is merely saying once you have approved that project, the university has the ability to bond at a higher level than it did before without coming before the legislature.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. I understand the difference in change there, but I think that we're talking about this as if we have to approve the projects if the university totally bonds for it and pays for it itself. And I think that this language says that we only have to approve it, even receipt authority, if it's above the service debt of $2.5 million. So if you would check with legal and everything else, because I think that we just need to have the understanding. We don't want to have a misunderstanding of what the bonding authority is. We don't want wrong on the record or anything else. So as it goes to Finance Committee, that's fine with me, but I think that we want to make sure that we're discussing this in the right vein, and I'm not opposing it. I'm just wanting to make sure that we get it clarified so that everybody's understanding of how the bonding authority and our approval for projects, how it works. It just seems to be at odds with the language, and I'm not holding it up for that reason. That's the existing law, but I just want to make sure that we all have accurate understanding of how it works.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mike Kelly. And just for clarity, Mr. Chairman, we're talking about line 9 beginning with the university and continuing through line 13 on page 1. And we will get the answer from law, as well as probably Mr. Dosh, so that we understand how they see that and how the Department of Law sees that. So we will take care of that.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Are there further questions? We have our public testimony. I'll open the public testimony. Do we have anybody in the audience that wants to testify on House Bill 184? And do we have anyone online? We have Myron
Dosh.
Dosh.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This is Myron Dosh at the University of Alaska, and I'm available for any questions. I must say that I've had a very difficult time hearing a lot of what's been said previously because it's been cutting in and out.
I think, Myron, that the only question that we had that maybe you could answer was on the university's need to get legislative approval for bonded projects that are below the limit. Do those projects have to get approval of the legislature, or as long as they're below the limit, the current $1 million or the proposed $2,500,000, do those go without legislative approval, or do they require legislative approval, some receipt authority for those bonds, or does the university have the ability to issue the bonds below that level without coming to the legislature?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The answer is yes, the university can issue the debt if it's below that level. The way in which the legislature approves those projects is through the receipt authority.
Mr. Dosh, I guess the question is, let's say you had a $5 million building on a campus and the university decided to issue debt for that and build it on their own, not going through a capital project request of the legislature. Can the university do that on its own as long as its anticipated expenses are going to be less than, or debt service would be less than the $2.5 million?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay, thank you. And that's the way I read the law. I just wanted to make sure that we were clear on the record, that we weren't misunderstanding something. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Myron, my question is, just so that I'm trying to get this straight in my mind. So if the university came to the legislature and asked for something and we didn't give it to them, could they turn around and bond and do it anyway?
The answer is no. We still need the receipt authority of the capital project to issue that debt.
Okay, thank you.
Get some more.
So, okay, we'll get a little more clarity on that as we go. Are there other questions for the university? And we don't have anything in the packet here from the university requesting this or saying how it would affect the university. Are you submitting a letter, or is the university going to be submitting a letter requesting this? Or I presume that your testimony is that you support House Bill 184?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I do support House Bill 184. I was not intending to issue a separate statement.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kelly.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dosh is, I assume, through the chair, representing the university when he says I support. That means the university supports, and through the chair. Is that correct, Mr. Dosh?
Yes.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to get a letter for you if you'd like one.
Thank you. And I think that it would be helpful in the packet to have something from, you know, in the president's office or someplace.
We can certainly arrange that. Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Starting on 9, the university, the language is a little bit confusing. It takes a lot of reading and rereading to really understand it. And I'm thinking that if you insert, the university may not enter into an obligation requiring a financing notice for projects greater than $2,500,000 under this section. Or just, if you could just clarify the amount again in that sentence, I think that would clear it up.
Representative Kelly.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mike Kelly. And I agree that in listening to this conversation, that the existing law sounds as if there might be an inconsistency, because we've said on the one hand that the legislature gets its cut at this by receipt authority, and yet also we've had the line of questioning said, well, in a project for which the university is asking for nothing from the university, could they bond it? And the answer to that was yes, I believe. So I would like to have to put a little more effort into getting that answered, Mr. Chairman, now that we're on this bill, and I know that you operate under the theory that they only come past us once in a while, and if you see something wrong, you probably ought to call it out, and I agree with that completely. So what we'll do is we'll talk to law and to finance at the university. And the worry I have through the chair, Representative Munoz, just sticking that in there, is let's assume for a moment that this has allowed the interpretation, Mr. Chairman, that you have, and that has given them a great deal of flexibility, as I understand it would. I would not want to accidentally on a bill that they've asked for to give them more headroom, at least to restore the original headroom, and end up inserting something that cuts the legs right out from under what they've been doing for a long time. So, if it's all right with the chair, I'd like to do a little more work on that.
we'd appreciate that, and I also want to point out that what we're talking about in the first part is that an annual payment anticipated to exceed $2.5 million. So it's not the cost of the project, it's the cost of the annual payment. And if that's over a 20-year or 30-year, or I mean, you could very definitely, if it's a 5-year repayment or a 20-year repayment, that would be a significantly different annual payment anticipation. So anyway, if you would address those for us, that would be helpful.
We'd be happy to, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mike Kelly.
Are there further questions? Is there anyone else to testify online? Seeing no one else to testify online, I'm going to close the public hearing. Committee discussion. Representative Kelly, I'd like to hold this for another hearing. You can get back with us on. It's not my intent to hold the bill, but we would like to get that information back to the committee so we have full understanding when we pass.
Representative Mike Kelly, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we'll have online the right folks so that if there are questions at that time, we should be able to get it out in one helping here. Thank you.
Great, thanks. And if there are no other questions or comments, we'll put House Bill 184 aside for bringing up at a later date, and we'll be able to do that under bills previously heard as soon as you let us know that you have the information and people ready to go.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
is there anything else? I wanted to say that on Wednesday we'll hold a subcommittee meeting of the whole, and that will be from 8 to 9 on Wednesday, and we will be talking about the stimulus money. And I want to make it clear for people that are listening, as I don't see us being in contention with the administration on this issue. My conversations have been, we want to make sure that we have good, clear policies on what the money would be used for, how it would go forward, and then we will have those discussions as to the state's obligations and future obligations. And I hope everyone that's listening will understand that what we're trying to do is go forward with this in a way that we can work best for schools. So that will be our intent. And we will have the commissioner and other folks here for that subcommittee meeting that will be teleconferenced. And that will be on Wednesday at 8 to 9. And then at 9 o'clock, we will convene our regular meeting and take up HB 94 and best post-secondary scholarships and the entire subject of post-secondary scholarships will be on the table. You have been distributed to the committee a matrix from the Commission on Post-Secondary Education that we requested about the elements of a loan or a scholarship program, needs-based, merit-based, and some analyses on the effect of each one of those choices out of that matrix that we would make. So I would hope that people would take a look through that that matrix ahead of next meeting, and our intent is to look at all of the elements of a loan program and decide if the committee wants to restructure a loan program or a scholarship grant program and pose that as a committee. So that'll be our where we're going on Wednesday. That'll be from 9 to 10, so anyone's interested there. Are there further questions? Yes, Representative Gardner and then Booth.
Will the 9 o'clock, the 8 to 9 portion be televised? I'd like to let my constituents know, because there's been a lot of interest in this area.
We will request
teleconference, but I don't know.
Yeah, Gavel to Gavel does its own things. It covers mm-hmm. some committee meetings, doesn't cover others, cover some caucuses or subcommittee meetings and not others. And so we'll request that they cover it by teleconference, but we will have it on the LIO and we'll have it on the audio teleconference, because we have we've got an agreement on that. But as far as we don't know what Gavel to Gavel will do yet, but we'll request that.
So just to make sure I understand, does that mean people could go to the LIO and listen in? Okay.
That's correct. The LIO will have it, and they can listen in. I just don't know about
thank you.
The video Gavel to Gavel. That's an independent body.
Right.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned Commissioner Ledoux will be at this, and you mentioned other folk. Who other folk would that be?
The Les Morris, I believe, is their expert on the stimulus.
Okay.
I think it was Les, wasn't it? Yeah. And he's the person from the administration, the Department of Education. And that's the part of the stimulus we're talking about. We're not talking about other aspects, just those outer education. And, you know, it's kind of an odd thing because stimulus is really money and it's kind of a finance thing, but it's not, because there's going to be many policies that we can implement with that. So we're looking at, again, mainly on the policies and the educational policies. There may be some potential for such things as, you know, we've sent forward a budget that had a $2 million grant program for early childhood education. There may be some potential within this that could be expanded to include more than 500 students across the state. The, you know, that's an RFP process, a request for a proposal process that'll be going forward. And we have on Friday, the administration will be here to fill us in on that the parameters that they're looking at for those early childhood grant pieces. And so that might, you know, it all relates to kind of the same thing, programs for kids. And so that's the aspect we'll be looking at as far as the stimulus goes, money.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, we will be adjourned at 9:01.